Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Monday on the Savage Nation. Well, I think I'm 9/11 out. How about you? Especially since Islam was expunged from any mention in the 9/11 memorial services. I mean, I watched with astonishment over the weekend, and every ceremony did not mention the 400-pound gorilla in the room. Nobody mentioned who drove the planes into the World Trade Centers. It was as though radical Islam no longer existed. This doesn't exist. Never existed. In fact, it got so bad that CNN ran a piece on 9/11 which said, "We are remembering 9/11 when two planes crashed into the World Trade Center," as if the planes crashed by accident. And then they had the nerve to show that the main victims of 9/11 were American Muslims. In papers throughout America, opinion pieces on the benign Sharia law and on jihad as a nonviolent struggle for the soul. It is a complete lie. It's as though it's 1940-ish, December 7th, 1941, Japanese attack Pearl Harbor, and then a year or 10 years later, you commemorate Pearl Harbor and you don't mention who did it to you. Or you send your boys into war. Well, let me put it another way. I have a neighbor in one of the houses I live in who's 90 years old. I can't believe it because he rides his bike and I run into him all the time. He fought with Patton in World War II on a tank. I mean, this guy's a hero of mine. He's 90, rides a bike. He's blind in one eye. He's deaf in his ears. And the guy's got a smile on his face. He actually was in a tank, fought with Patton through Europe, right? I said, when you were fighting the Nazis, it would be as if you were told to go and take out the tank without knowing who was in the tank. Or if you were being attacked by a tank, you'd be told tanks are attacking you rather than Nazis are attacking you. He said, "That's right. We couldn't have fought the war. We knew who our enemy was. We knew the face of our enemy, and we hated our enemy. But you see, because we now live in a benign America that has lost its ability to not only defend itself, but to define itself and define its enemies, the enemies are defining us as their enemy, but we refuse to accept that they are our enemy." And so, as I say to you, I watched this stuff over the weekend. I could not take it. I want to read for you what one man has to say. This is a war of terrorism by the forces and regimes of radical Islam. Radical Islam threatens moderate Islamic and Arab regimes. It threatens the very existence of the State of Israel and its linking up with radical regimes. It brings the tools of terrorism to Israeli civilians and to Americans, by the way. And he said it hangs over all of us. We must unite all countries that aspire to life. Now, I want to say this. We're facing 1,000 years of darkness, because if radical Islam should win, and don't for 1 minute think that it can't win, it's won before. By the way, how do you think Islam spread throughout the world so rapidly in such a short period of time? Do you think it was through love? You think it was through preaching love? It was through warfare. It was through an ideology of conquest. It was through the sword and the flame. It's the most extremist ideology on the planet, radical Islam. And that's why I was banned in Britain, because I said these exact words 10 years ago. I said it again 5 years ago, and I'm saying it again for you now. Did you hear me? And now I want to turn to today. On the Savage Nation. It's very important. My novel is launched tomorrow. It will be in bookstores as of today or tomorrow, Abuse of Power. The reason you have to read the book is because it's not just a story. Fiction it is. But it's about one honest man and his attempt to stop the next 9/11. That's correct. It's not just a story about nothing. Jack Hatfield tries to stop the next 9/11. From the New York Times best-selling author and nationally syndicated radio talk show host, comes a high-intensity debut thriller, the story of a smeared network journalist who uncovers a chilling terrorist plot. Sound familiar? I name him Jack Hatfield. That's my character, right? He's a hardened former war correspondent who rose to national prominence for his insight, provocative commentary. But after being smeared as a bigot and extremist by a radical leftist media watchdog group, does that sound familiar to you? He ultimately loses his job and finds himself working in obscurity as a freelance news producer in San Francisco. One afternoon, Hatfield is on a ride along with the SFPD bomb squad when a seemingly routine carjacking turns deadly. After police find several pounds of military-grade explosives in the jacked car, and when the FBI urges Jack Hatfield to stay out of it, he knows he's onto something big. Sound familiar? This event will open up a shadowy trail that leads Hatfield from San Francisco to Tel Aviv, London, Paris, and back again, as he works with a stunning Yemeni intelligence agent and a veteran Green Beret to expose a terrorist group known as the Hand of Allah and a plot within the highest corridors of power that will dwarf 9/11. In this lightning-paced first thriller spanning the globe from Europe and Israel to the back alleys of San Francisco's Chinatown, a reporter must make the choice between protecting his own life and investigating a terrorist cell whose goal is nothing less than the total political control, no matter what the cost. That's from the jacket of my new novel, Abuse of Power, a thriller. As I say to you, it's very important to me that I hear what you have to say about my book, because it's not just a story. Although Jack Hatfield is a fictional hero, there's an awful lot more in there than just fiction. And so I'm going to ask you, if you've received a copy of the book, what is your favorite political line in Abuse of Power? It's not heavily political, but believe me, my characters have a lot to say politically, and they say it. There's Jack Hatfield, there's Tony Antonori, a former Vietnam Green Beret. He's in his 50s, but he can whip guys 20. He plays a very big role later on in the book. What is your favorite political line in Abuse of Power? What is your favorite humorous line that I wrote in Abuse of Power? Which character in my novel Abuse of Power fascinates you the most and why? Which fictional hero does Jack Hatfield remind you of the most? If Abuse of Power were to come out as a movie, who do you think should play Jack Hatfield? Which scene in the book do you think was best described? And finally, which famous historical work of fiction would you most closely compare Abuse of Power to in terms of style? I would not compare it stylistically to Jack London, but I'm going to make a prediction for you. I believe this book will become a raging bestseller worldwide in many languages for a number of reasons. One, it's a great story. Two, it's about the next 9/11 that's stopped by one honest man. And three, and this is probably the most important point as to why it will sell worldwide and why you're going to buy it, it's because one of the heroes is a Muslim woman whose brother was killed by the hand of Allah in her native Yemen. You see, there are hundreds of millions of middle-of-the-road Muslims. They just want the white picket fence and a rose garden just like you do. But you never, ever hear from them. You never hear from them any more than you hear from African-Americans who are not radical leftists. Any more than you hear from Jews who support the state of Israel. All you hear are the fanatics who hate Israel, the marchers, okay? So there are many things in this book that are political. Although it's not a political book, there are political lines. I also have a great treat for you on the Savage Nation today. I played it last week, but I feel obligated to do it one more time before this time leaves us again. America is focused on 9/11/01. And all I heard over the weekend, as I said at the beginning of this monologue, was tepid drivel. Not one mention of the radical Islamic ideology that threatens to take over the entire world. The former Bishop of Rochester, Michael Nazir Ali, who came to England to escape religious persecution in Pakistan, obviously he's a Christian, he wrote the following in an interview with The Telegraph. He said, at the heart of extremism is an ideology, a worldview, and not just concerning the perceived wrong done to the Muslim ummah or people. Such an ideology expects Islam to dominate rather than to accept the subservient place in world affairs. Let me tell you again. Such an ideology expects Islam to dominate rather than to accept a subservient place in world affairs. One lying politician after another has told you Islam means peace. It doesn't mean peace. What it means is something entirely different. It does not mean peace at all. And he goes on now. He says it promotes pan-Islam and the ultimate rejection of nation states, even Muslim ones. It may be that some extremists chatter about an Islamic State in this part of the world or that. However, its ultimate aim is a single Islamic political, social, economic, and spiritual entity. Shall I go on? I will when I return, but when I come back, sometime within this hour, I have a big treat for you again. It's not going to be a tepid speech. It's not going to be an unemotional speech. It's not going to be garbage you heard on Fox News as though it was just another event like a flood. No. It's going to be me, yours truly, Michael Savage, as I spoke on that day of infamy, 9/11/01, and you're going to hear the reality of me all over again right here on the Savage Nation.
Savage.
Can you imagine if after World War II started, the U.S. media were to be running sympathetic stories about the plight of American Germans? Or could you imagine if after World War II started, if the U.S. media had run articles about the plight of American Japanese day in and day out? Well, that's what's happening in America. To show you how intelligent and how successful the Muslim lobby is in America, by watching the 9/11 commemorations over the last weekend, you would think that the people who suffered the most, the number of people who died in the greatest numbers, were Muslims. It was astonishing to listen to this garbage when the news had reached such a level that they said, we are remembering 9/11 when two planes crashed into the World Trade Center without saying it was crashed by Muslims. And make no mistake about it, although there were only 19 or 20 actors involved, who drove those planes, got on the planes and killed people in cold blood, cutting their throats while chanting to Allah, by the way, there were thousands who supported them with finances and logistics. And make no mistake about it, the way they were able to get on that plane at Logan Airport was because of vermin with law degrees called liberal lawyers who threatened to sue the government and threatened to sue airlines if they looked at Muslims the wrong way. Don't think I don't remember what went on. I remember every detail of it. And I am sitting here right now. I'm sitting here right now, 10 years later, shocked that the Muslim lobby is so successful that you morons, you fools, you shills, you weaklings, you saps, you drug addicts, you porno freaks, take this garbage from these people. And that's why I wrote Abuse of Power. It's my last chance to awaken this country. That's correct. Yeah, it's a novel, sure. It's a story, sure. But it's about a man trying to stop the next 9/11. I hope to God it sells worldwide. I hope they come to see who's really involved. Because if you think the villains are only radical Muslims, you're mistaken. As Jack Hatfield will show you in the novel, there's some U.S. senators involved. There are some shadowy people who fled the Europe of World War II, who wound up being the enemies of freedom themselves while posing as victims. Oh, yeah. It goes all the way up to the top. It goes all the way up to the top. And that's why I say I need you to go tomorrow and mob the bookstores. And I'm only going to do this for a few days. I'm telling you right now, I'm not going to do this for very long. And here's why. Because I am sick and tired of hearing people complain about the movies that are being produced by the Hollywood leftists. They're sick and tired of the books that are being published by the publishing left wing. And so now you have a chance to go out and say, all right, Savage, you sold me. I'm going to buy that book. I'll contribute towards the conversion of the mindset in America. If you don't do it, don't blame me. And by the way, if I sold 1,000 copies, 10,000 copies, or 1,000,000 copies, it wouldn't change my lifestyle. Let me repeat that. If you think I'm doing this because I want to buy a new car, you're crazy. If you think I'm doing this because I want to buy a new house, you're crazy. No, my friends, I'm way past that point in my life. In fact, I told you and I'll tell you again. Every dollar in royalties that I make over and above my advance will go into the Savage Legal Fund. And after I am through fighting England to restore my honor and my name, and after I'm through with all of my legal fights, I will take any money that is left and give it to a conservative legal fund. Okay, is that enough for you? Yeah, that's what it is. That's where I'm at. 1-800-449-8255, Atlanta, Georgia. First caller today, Sarah. Fire away. You're on the Savage Nation.
Hello, my favorite alpha male. I'd like to suggest whom you should choose for playing Jack Hatfield.
Who?
Daniel Craig.
Yes. Perhaps my favorite actor.
Yes,
He's sympathetic. He's sympathetic without being over the top. He's not a muscular fool. He doesn't have any tattoos. He doesn't look like a clown. And yet he does get away with playing a hero. You're right, and he's the right age bracket for it.
Too tall.
Did you see Daniel Craig in Confessions of a Fool?
Flashbacks of a Fool, yes. On your
What an incredibly... I hate to use the word because it sounds... what an incredibly nuanced movie that is. It's beautiful. God, it was beautiful.
Yes.
I was sure that movie would win every award, but it didn't. Because there were no guns in it, you see, and there were no rap stars with bling hanging out of their nostrils. So therefore, it didn't sell too well. Sarah, I'm sending you a copy of Abuse of Power. I'm sure you'll love it. Next caller, David in New York on WOR. Go ahead, please.
Yes, hi. My idea to play the original character, Jack Hatfield, was Clive Owen.
He's Who is he? I know the name. What does he look like?
He's a tallish fellow. I think he actually might be British, but he played a journalist. He's not too muscular over the top, like you said before. And
right.
He's played a journalist in some movies.
So you think he'd be a good lead for the character, Hatfield? You haven't read the book or seen it yet, have you?
No, just from listening to you talk about it.
All right, well, I'm going to give you a free copy. It's going out today. Michael Savage's Abuse of Power going out to you. By the way, everyone's a winner this week. Anyone who gets on the air gets a free book. It's a beautiful gift, by the way. You don't pay anything for it, but it's my way of saying thank you for calling the show with your ideas. But the bigger picture is 9/11 and the expunging of radical Islam across America. I'm sick from it. I'm ill from it. They're winning. Not only did they win by taking away our freedoms and giving so much power to Big Sis and the other governmental agents who are now running us like little lab animals, but they won because you're not even allowed to mention that their brethren did it to us. That's what I think. And when I come back, you'll see the difference between what I said on 9/11/01, which I'm going to play for you here on the Savage Nation. Lucky we have it in the archives. And what you heard over the weekend from the Pinocchios in the media. Including the Pinocchios who wrapped themselves in the flag, who did not once mention the word Islam, radical Islam. They didn't mention it. You know why? Because most of the networks are now owned by very big money from the Middle East.
Savage.
It is September 12th, 2011, Michael Savage, and I'm sitting here sick to my stomach over the tepid, ferocious lie that occurred over the last 3 days with men like Mayor Bloomberg, Rudy Giuliani, former President Bush, and all of the others being caponized by the radical Muslim lobbies around America into not even reminding us who did it to us. We can never win this war. In fact, we're losing this war. If you lose the war of ideas, you lose the war on the battlefield. If you lose the desire to even understand who your enemy is. And listen to the words I just chose. If you lose the desire to even know who your enemy is, how can you fight your enemy? They know who you are. They define you as their enemy every day. They define you as their enemy every day. They have names for you. They call you dimmies. They call you every name under the sun. They call you crusaders. But you have no name for them. You're not allowed to say who they are. You're not allowed to even know who they are. You see no evil, you hear no evil. You think by being a nice liberal like Dr. Spock, you think by being Mr. Rogers that the radical Muslims are going to like you, you stupid schmucks, you. What have you learned from history? Have you not learned what psychotic maniacs are like? Have you not learned what bullies are like? Have you not understood the first thing about 9/11? I don't actually blame you. I don't blame you. You're like a bunch of drug children in a schoolroom being taught to sing with your enemy while your enemy is plotting to cut your throat. Having said all of that, I'm going to take a few calls in a moment, and then I'm going to play a real speech from 9/11/01. In fact, I'm going to do it right now. Play it. Of the United States of America. The radical Muslim world has declared war on America. We are at war. We are at war. Attention, America. This is your Pearl Harbor. This is your Pearl Harbor. In the World Trade Center today, a World Trade Center that no longer exists,
demolished by two hijacked airliners, taken over by radical Muslims. Ladies and gentlemen, you will never forget this day as long as you live. It is time for you to come out of your sleep. It is time for you to put your hats on forward. It is time for you to throw your pornography in a bonfire. It is time for you to turn off your sports. It is time for you to turn off your entertainment. You will not have a nation unless you awaken and stand up like a man. What can be done? I want to remind you that we are at war. We do not know the exact count of fatalities at the World Trade Center. As you well know, radical Muslims hijacked these two planes. In fact, on the web right now, we have intelligence that two connected to bin Laden said over private airwaves, we hit two targets. We hit two targets. Those two targets, of course, are the World Trade Center in New York City, no longer existent. I'm going to remind you that the United States went to war when Pearl Harbor was attacked, when 2,800 or 2,700 or 2,900 boys were killed by the Japanese. Ladies and gentlemen, what will it take for this country to close the borders, to reassert English as our language, to stop the flood of asylees from every garbage can in the world? This is the result of a weakened nation. Ladies and gentlemen, we are at war. What must be done? Where are Bush and Cheney? What emergency steps are you taking? 1-800-449-8255 is the phone number on the Savage Nation. This is a day that will live in infamy, but I want to tell you this. Many of you are frightened in the false assumption that terrorism cannot be fought against. That is the wrong assumption. It is the wrong conclusion. That is what you're going to hear from the defeatists. I want to remind everyone listening to Michael Savage that Japan's kamikaze attacks ended only after Truman dropped two atomic bombs on Japan. I will repeat that. Kamikazes never act on their own. They are financed, they are trained, and they are supplied by governments. Kamikazes do not act on their own. Japan's kamikaze attacks ended only after we dropped two atomic bombs on their homeland. We must atomize their training camps. We must atomize their training camps now. And I am not the only one who knows this. Congressman Rohrbacher from Orange County, California, this morning was furious. He had been trying to warn the morons at the highest level for months now that this was coming. And they called him a right-wing maniac. They ridiculed Rohrbacher. They dismissed him as a right-wing nut. Maybe you've dismissed me as a right-wing nut. When I've been telling you for years, close the borders. Where do you think the terrorists came from? How do you think they got into our country? You morons, I've been telling you that ultra-tolerance is killing us. Well, the day has come. This is your Pearl Harbor. You're going to live with it just as I am. I am telling you that this is a direct result of ultra-tolerance. This is a direct result of open borders. This is a direct result of a politically corrected society that is afraid to call what it is. Everybody knows who did this. Everybody knows who's behind this. Everybody knows what must be done. Where is Bush? Where is Cheney? What emergency steps are you taking? What emergency steps are you taking now that we are at war? Do you have any idea what is going on? Do you have any idea what has happened to your country? Do you know that your life will never be the same? Are you aware that your comfort level has changed forever? Do you comprende, amigo? We are at war. I've been trying to stop this. I've been telling you about it. I've been warning you about it. Dateline, Cairo, Egypt, today. Bullseye says Egyptians as they celebrate anti-U.S. attacks. Egyptian students, taxi drivers, shopkeepers celebrating in Cairo. Bullseye commented two of them as they watched footage of the Twin Towers of your World Trade Center shrouded in plumes of smoke. Another Egyptian man told AFP he was pleased with the wave of violence in which another plane crashed into the Pentagon in Washington. Nice work, said Abdel Karim, who drives a car for an Asian embassy. He said, and I quote, "The Americans have forgotten that God exists. They have us by the throat, and now they find themselves in a science fiction film scenario, but this time Rambo's not there to save the White House." Ladies and gentlemen, Abdel Karim hailed the attacks as the best thing that's happened since the October war. Egyptian is considered an ally of the United States. Egyptian is considered one of the moderate countries in the Middle East. Khalil Matar, 43, who works in a state-run soap factory, said, "The Americans are cowards. They use other countries to hit us. They don't have the courage to meet us face to face. The myth of the indestructible United States has gone up in smoke." What about the women of Egypt? Compassion? Let's listen to Polytechnic student Amira Riyad, who said, "We saw the World Trade Tower crash down," referring, of course, to the towers going down. She said, quote, "I only wish U.S. President George Bush and his dear little baby, Ariel Sharon, had been buried in there, too. There are your moderate Arabs. Where is the muscular reaction? Where are the men of America? Where is the leadership of America? Next, we're going to hear that we're going to get counselors going out so you can get on your hands and knees and pray. They'll tell you what color ribbon to put on."
Savage.
A little different than what you heard over the weekend from Mayor Bloomberg. I couldn't believe the nature of the so-called commemorations. They wouldn't say the word radical Islam. They wouldn't say Muslim. Instead, CNN went so far as to make Muslims the victims of 9/11. It was as though I was living not in Alice in Wonderland, but in the United States of America under Barack Hussein Obama, our first Muslim president. Now, I have a reader's comment that I picked up out of the newspaper, one Emma Garcia, who was arguing with people on a thread underneath an article where some Muslims were saying that it was that Islam took over most of the world as a result of the superiority of the religion and the spirituality of the struggle. Here's what she wrote. She said it wasn't a spiritual struggle that in only a few centuries inspired, organized, and executed the Mohammedan conquests of the Arabian Peninsula, the Middle East, the Byzantine Empire, the Sassanid Persian Empire, North Africa, Sicily, the Iberian Peninsula to the Pyrenees, the Indian subcontinent, Central Asia, and to the borders of China. No, she said it was jihad, holy war, a holy war whose limitless tactics and totalitarian strategies are outlined in detail in the ultimate military manual, the Quran. This same Quran, as well as the words and deeds of Muhammad, inspired and justified the millions of Muslims who funded, the thousands of Muslims who organized, and the few dozen Muslims who carried out the Islamic attack on America on 9/11/01. Do you disagree with Emma Garcia? Or do you agree with Emma Garcia? I'm one of those who agrees with Emma Garcia, and I am not going to be brainwashed. I have paid the price. I have been banned from entering Britain for saying what I said to you just now on this show many times. They won't even let me in that country anymore because they've been taken over. That's correct. And if you think we're far behind you, I got another guest coming for you. And my last hope of awakening you and the world is my novel. I switched gears. I went from nonfiction. I've had one bestseller after another to fiction. I figured, look, you can only do so much with factual books. I mean, the book sold very well. Many people read it. They understand what's in it. In fact, my call for tariffs on goods coming in from China was picked up by Trump, and then it was picked up even by surprise of surprises, the a man who gave us Romney Care, which is Obamacare Jr. But I wanted to do something different, so I wrote a novel called Abuse of Power, a thriller. It's out tomorrow. You know that now. It's going to be in every bookstore in America. And I'm asking you, you want to change the shape of books? You want to change the shape of movies? You want to change the mentality in this country? Well, okay, read the book. What else can I say to you? It's as simple as that. And by the way, while you're thinking about that, tell me if there was one word that I said in that 9/11/01 day, which was, I didn't write the speech. It was purely one from the heart and very emotional. I made two mistakes. I said Egyptian instead of Egypt. When I was saying Egypt is supposed to be our ally, I meant to say Egypt is supposed to be our ally. I said instead Egyptian is supposed to be our ally. I was very emotionally overwrought by what had happened to us on 9/11, unlike Neil Cavuto or Bill O'Reilly or Sean Hannity, who did what they were told to do by the 20% ownership from a Saudi prince, in my estimation. So there we are. That's where we are. I'll be right back.
Savage.
It is the Savage Nation. Now we read that Italy is going to be bailed out by China, and the very same people who are going to China to bail them out wrote extensively in the past about their fears of China's reverse colonization of Europe. China's already colonized the United States of America. The Arabians have colonized the United States of America. Take a look at Geithner and you'll know where we're at. All you got to do is take a look at Geithner. He can't even pay his own mortgage on a house he owns in South Queens. That's all you need to know. Treasury Secretary can't pay his own mortgage. Take a look at that Schmendrick. He looks like a bag man for a handbag company in New York City. Looks like a garment center Schmendrick who couldn't even turn a dreidel during Purim. Steve in New York, welcome to the Savage Nation from WOR.
I listened to your 9/11 broadcast, Mike. Your words bring back many horrible memories, but you know, we knew who the enemy was then. And you make a very good point. You have to know who your enemy is, identify it in order to be able to defeat it.
Well, they know they know who their enemy is. How come they know who their enemy is? Make no mistake about it, they're teaching their children who their enemy is. They call Christians crusaders. They teach their children to hate you. And we teach our children to take medication in case they feel a real emotion.
This is what I'll say, Steve. If you know anybody in the military intelligence community, they will tell you that since this president has been elected, we've taken our foot off the pedal. And I'm not a big fan of George Bush, but I don't like his public.
Well, let's not bring up that name. He was sitting on a chair in a schoolroom when it happened, and then he disappeared. George Bush, I don't know. I have very mixed feelings about him. He ruined the government by expanding it to an extent that we can't even climb back from where he put us. So let's not turn Bush into a hero. Yes, compared to Obama, he was George Washington. In either case, I'm sending you a copy of Abuse of Power. And now for your listening pleasure, because I'm getting too excited already, I'm going to read you a sex scene from Abuse of Power. There is nothing lewd in what I'm about to read. In fact, I will stop before there's really no X-rated part of it, but it gets close. So at that point, I will stop reading. Jack had known Tony Antinori for a little over a year, but the moment he'd met the guy, they'd felt an immediate kinship, and that was the kind of compliment he didn't hand out often. A former Green Beret paratrooper, Tony had done 3 tours in Vietnam, had cross-trained as both a medic and a rifleman, and was still active in the National Guard teaching combat medicine to young recruits headed to Afghanistan. This is page 31 of Abuse of Power. He was 69 and still teaching field medicine to the young recruits. Maybe that was part of what kept him young, having to shame the know-it-all out of kids less than half his age. The other part was staying in shape. He was solidly built, more muscle than fat, but at first glance you'd never know that he was career military. He looked like a fugitive from a Fellini movie. His thick head of shoe-polished black movie star hair framing a tanned, creased, bearded face and wise but playful eyes. He kept his lanky 6'4" frame in shape with a brisk morning flurry of push-ups, jumping jacks, and crunches every other day. Nothing high impact, just enough to get his heart rate up and help keep his cholesterol down. He dressed younger too, casual, mostly turtlenecks and corduroys, and he dyed his white hair black as one concession of vanity. If he squinted, he could still find and sometimes talk to the 20-year-old who always wanted to be where he ended up. That sense of accomplishment was the real reward, though sometimes there was unexpected blowback. Tony had once told him the story of Beth Middleton and how he was attracted to her the instant he saw her. The woman's smile hooked him and her tight jeans held him. Her quick wit did its job, too. In that sense, he was not unlike most men. It was lust at first sight. Beth was 30 years younger than him, but something about her was much older. When they finally got around to talking about something other than medicine, he learned that she had grown up in a military family, moving from base to base, though she had managed to stick around the Florida Panhandle near Panama City long enough to go to high school. Maturity is something he found in a lot of Army brats, because they never really got to put down roots, because they rarely got to make friends for very long. Their lives were spent on the outside, reading when they were alone, watching when they were with people. Beth's father had been a lieutenant colonel in the Air Force. He flew 100 combat missions in Nam in the F-4, a classy long-range Mack Buster that was still being used in the Gulf War. The skyjacks always said if you had to be away from home, and honey, this was the baby you wanted to be with. Lieutenant Colonel Middleton apparently felt the same. He later became a flight instructor, keeping close to the Phantoms, married late and had Beth even later. She worshipped her father and craved his attention, which he obviously didn't bestow as readily or happily as he did lectures on the range of his big silver bird. Beth didn't have to say it for Tony to figure out that he was the reason she was attracted to older men. He didn't imagine he was the first. After college, she earned her master's in Arabic language studies from Texas A&M, and after hours, snagged a Ph.D. in MDS, Marquis de Sade. She liked to be dominated and humiliated, something Tony didn't know till later. I will pause right here about the intimacy that follows on pages 32 to 34 of Abuse of Power. But I can guarantee you that it's done very classily. I don't have to revert to the level of the gangbanger or to the illiterate pothead. to get your attention, believe me. 1-800-449-8255, michaelsavage.com. Let's go to Tampa, Florida. Eric, you're on the program. Go ahead, please.
Hey, sir, regarding your expulsion of the mention of Islam on 911, I've been a Catholic all my life, went to Mass this past Sunday, September 11th. There wasn't one mention of September 11th till after the Gospel, and the first reading in Gospel dealt with not getting angry.
That's right. Love thy enemy as thyself. Right. That got Jesus very far, didn't it?
I am fed up with it. It's almost prayers for the faithful. They said, "Oh well, let's bless the super committee on debt forgiveness." Are you serious?
I thought there's supposed to be a separation of church and state. Look, my friend, organized religion is a business. Make no mistake about it. They're so tied in with the government, it's frightening. In fact, if you check out your church's connections to government grants, I think you'd be quite surprised to find out there really is no differential between church and state, especially when it comes to the Catholic Church and governmental monies. And I know that they don't like me very much, because I once criticized one of the cardinals who had the nerve to tell the American people that we had to legalize illegal aliens. Well, I think he was wrong. I know he's wrong. And he has no business telling us that we should legalize illegal aliens just because they want to they want more people in the pews. I said it then and I'll say it again. Separation of church and state. And I'm going to send you a copy of Abuse of Power. That's all. I have another question for you before this hour comes to a conclusion and before I burn myself out altogether. Although I feel very, very energized. I had a dream last night. You're never going to believe this dream, those of you who listen regularly. I dreamed I was standing in a thunderstorm with lightning, and both my hands were up, and I was screaming, "I am Thor." I swear to God. In fact, I had no clothing on, and I was standing in a lightning storm with both hands up reaching to the heavens, and I felt the power of heavens running through my body. You know why? Because I feel healed.
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
Now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Tuesday. Welcome to the Savage Nation. The Savage Nation. You know, tomorrow is D-Day for me, actually. Tomorrow is D-Day for Abuse of Power, where everything is riding on this tomorrow. I need you to go into the bookstore, and I need you simply to buy the book, Change the World by Changing the Images. I want you to mob the bookstores and buy the book, period. And then I want to have some fun on the show, as we do every time I publish a book. I want you to call into this show with your bookstore horror stories. You know, the clerks with green hair, you know, the clerks with a certain attitude, you know, the bookstore clerks who hide the book and put it in the children's section under cooking. We're also talking about Islam being expunged from the 9/11 memorial services and the shocking lies coming out of Barack Obama about the memorial of 9/11. But it was not limited to Barack Obama. The fact of the matter is the entire media also expunged radical Islam from 9/11 memorials, which was shocking to me. It couldn't have gotten any lower than CNN showing Muslims as the ultimate victims of 9/11. I thought that was the most perverse view I'd ever seen in my entire life. It was as though Islam was the victim. Muslims were the victim. It was amazing to me to see that this level of propaganda is being conducted in my country with hardly a notice of it. Astounding, by the way. And it just shows you the power of the Islamic lobbies in this country, especially CAIR, the Muslim Society of America. They are one of the most intelligent. They are amongst the most intelligent groups I have ever seen operating in this country. They must be able to buy some of the best Quislings available for money on K Street. That's all I can say. So what would you like me to do? Because this is a talk show. It's your show. I have my novel. I'm reading from it. I've asked you some interesting questions, such as if you've gotten the book. We're holding lines open for you if you've gotten one already. What's your favorite political line in any of the characters in Abuse of Power? What's your favorite funny line in Abuse of Power? Which characters or which character fascinates you the most and why, etc.? All here on the Savage Nation. Let's begin right now in Biloxi, Mississippi. Bobby, go ahead. You're up on the air. Go ahead, please.
Michael, sir, please, in the name of God, play that six-minute speech from 9/11. Please, every day during your three-hour show, we need to hear that.
Well, here's the thing. I cannot do it because the stations wouldn't permit it, but I do this. I've done this, rather. I've put it on michaelsavage.com. I'm going to leave it there, I think, forever. I'm going to ask my webmaster to leave the speech up because we loaded it up on the site, and you can get it anytime you want, and you can email it to friends, by the way, which I'd like you to do, Bobby, because I do think it's a seminal speech. I think it's a speech that people should hear. I really do, and I'm sending you a free copy to you of Abuse of Power going out now. Gorgeous cover, blue cover, Target on Jack. Would you like me to read another section? Would you like to talk about 9/11? Would you like to talk about the tepid nature of the 9/11 programs? Would you like to ask me some questions and I'll tell you no lies? New York, Robert, you're on the Savage Nation from WOR. Go ahead, please.
Yes, Michael, I was wondering how hard of a transition it was for you to go from nonfiction to fiction, and what authors may have been some sort of influence for you.
Well, let me start with this. I was a very bad fiction writer when I started, long before radio. In fact, I started by writing very bad short stories when I was very young. I have a carton full of them. Some of them are not really bad, but they are what you write when you're young, where everything is very self-centered and there's no real story. It's just about you or a character, a piece of you, and what you're feeling. And you confuse that with a story. You know what I'm saying? But I still have a carton filled with those. And one of these days, I intend to collect all of my early fiction and let people judge for themselves. Having said that, I then spent the next 20 years or whatever, or the last almost 20 years, 15, 18 years, I lose track of it since 94, it's 17 years in radio, writing nonfiction. But before that, I wrote books on health and nutrition and herbal medicine. You're asking how I went from one to the other. The answer is simple. It wasn't easy for the following reason. While I could easily write certain sections very readily, the actual plotting, the actual storytelling, the actual cutting it to the leanest mass and keeping the story moving was a very, very trying experience for me.
Yeah, I can understand. It's hard to, first you got to get started, but then you have to end also.
That's right. Well, Robert, I'm sending you a copy of the new book so that you can judge for yourself. You know, this is a funny line, but here in San Francisco, you would think that a city that prides itself on San Francisco would be thrilled to death that someone's just published a book that's all about, that's set in their city, for example, because this is known as a provincial city all over the world. Although the locals think that it's, you know, au courant and the head and San Francisco is laughed at around the world as a provincial city. It's a beautiful provincial city, and I live here for a number of reasons. You would think that they'd be proud of a local boy who wrote a book where the Golden Gate Bridge, the museums, especially the Palace of the Legion of Honor, certain amazing scenes from North Beach, Chinatown, Fisherman's Wharf, the cliff areas of San Francisco, underground tunnels that few people know about, are up here throughout this book, the Marin coastline. You'd think they would be thrilled about the book. But because I do not toe the party line, the communist totalitarian party line of the radical vermin in San Francisco, they're making believe the book doesn't exist. But I'm going to make a prediction right now. This book will sell worldwide. It'll be translated into many languages. They don't understand something. Some of my earlier nonfiction books, I'm going to name one because I like to be specific. Back in 86, I wrote a book called Maximum Immunity. And it was an early on book about the immune system and what you could do to stimulate immunity, how you could take antioxidants and certain vitamins. This is long before your doctor ever heard of the word antioxidant. Of course, everybody knows what that is today. Houghton Mifflin published the book. It was published in six languages. To this day, I'm very proud of Maximum Immunity in Swedish, in Danish, in Portuguese, in Spanish. The French, of course, didn't publish my edition. They stole it. A French writer did what French writers are known to do. They just stole the book and put their name on it. But nevertheless, there's a French edition of the book under somebody else's name. Italian edition. My books have been translated into other languages. I'm actually a literary phenomenon in America. And maybe only you know it. So let me read you a paragraph from Abuse of Power, page 267, without giving the plot away. Okay? They took a gently winding road along the bay. Hadad is one of the villains. Hadad looked out at its clear blue waters, marveling at its beauty as he watched the distant sailboats bob along its surface. He had always loved this view, with the Cliff House restaurant, the Marin coastline beyond, and the tattered sea-swept ruins of the Sutro Baths on the shore below, which had once been the world's largest indoor swimming establishment until it burned down before Hadad was even born. And yet it was soon to be so different by his hand. There were times when he wished that he could simply go back to his college days, when life was less complicated, when he could hate without having to rein that in, so he could carefully engineer an expression of that loathing. And to be honest, though he had been here to learn and to study the ways of the infidels, there were times he envied them, their blissful obliviousness to the world and its dangers. He wondered what life would be like without a larger goal than making money and raising infidel children. He wondered if in his lifetime he would ever know the peace and contentment of a Sharia world. They drove around a bend along Point Lobos Avenue until they came to a large car park on their left near the Sutro Baths. Tally pulled in and found a spot, then shut off the engine and turned to Hadad. "Okay," she said, "almost there. We're in a national park, so we have to be aware of other visitors and watchful eyes." "I'll trust you to guide me without incident," Hadad told her. She smiled again. "You are just so damn cute, you know that?" She parked and leaned over and kissed him, making it very clear that she enjoyed his company. He managed to keep from recoiling and actually returned her smile. "Shall we?" she said, as she popped open her door. Indeed. They found their way to Land's End Trail, which was far from rustic and perfectly maintained, surrounded by lush green foliage. They followed a winding path, feeling the wind in their faces, enjoying the quiet, which seemed so unusual considering that they were still in the city. As they passed the USS San Francisco Memorial, little more than a flagpole and plaque, surrounded by a few large gunmetal gray pieces of an old warship that to Hadad looked like giant dumpsters, Tally glanced about, then grabbed his arm and steered him toward the edge of the cliff. "This way," she said. The cliff looked quite steep, but they were both wearing clothes for climbing, jeans, flannel shirts, rugged shoes, so Hadad followed her down through the rocks and trees until they were very close to the water. He could feel the ocean spray on his face as she led him around a small outcropping, then upward again until they found a secluded patch of land just below the cliffside, full of dirt and rock and grass and surrounded by thick green trees. Page 268, Abuse of Power. Two more paragraphs. Glancing around again for prying eyes, Tally moved up to a large grouping of stones gathered near the base of one of the trees. Taking hold of the largest stone, she said, "Help me with this." Hadad grabbed on, and they huffed and struggled a few moments until they rolled it aside to reveal a crevice just wide enough to squeeze through. The crevice was formed in a slab of cement rather than earth, and Hadad could see that it was an exposed portion of a larger structure that had somehow been dislodged, possibly in an earthquake. "This is it?" Hadad asked. "This is the entrance?" "Only the brave know for sure," she said, casting a look around to make sure that they had not been observed. "You want me to go first?" Not one to back down from a challenge, especially coming from a ridiculous female, Hadad waved her away, then studied the crevice, looking for the best way to proceed. Deciding to go feet first, he sat down and stuck his feet into the opening, then lay on his back and slowly wormed his way downward, shimmying into the hole. As his feet penetrated the darkness, he felt the ground suddenly give way beneath them, nothing but open air below. Catching hold of the edge of the slab, he said, "How far is the drop?" "Not far," she told him. "Just let yourself go and be mindful how you land." He landed hard, but on his feet, the sound of the impact echoing against cement walls. Pulling a small flashlight out of his shirt pocket, he flicked it on and found himself inside a narrow concrete shaft. To his left was another shaft with a built-in rusted rebar ladder that led deeper into the earth. "Watch out," Tally said. "Here I come." And I guess I can't tell you any more because it's a big, big part of the plot. I'll be right back.
Savage.
is the Savage Nation. I got to admit, I'm very, very energized, excited. I've been waiting for this day for a long time right now. I got to admit it to you. I feared it. I was reluctant to see the day arrive. But here it is, the day before the launch of the book. It's going to be in the stores tomorrow. And I don't know how it's going to do. I mean, I hope it sells well, obviously. I told you that. I hope you love the book. I hope people love it. I don't care what the reviewers say, and I don't care what the people who hate me politically say. It doesn't matter to me. All that matters is what you think of me. So let me take a quick call. Dave in Sacramento, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Dr. Savage, it's a pleasure to talk to you. Can you shed a little light on the canine hero, Eddie, and his role in your book?
Okay. Okay, Eddie is based upon a real-life persona of my dog, Teddy, the 11-pound poodle. Teddy's 7 years old. Eddie, I don't know how old he is in the book, maybe five. By the way, I read an article yesterday about caring for your dog in his senior years. It was so touching. It was frightening. In fact, as I was going to sleep, I was playing with Teddy, and I said to him, Teddy, you're going to be a senior in only 2 years. You're my little senior dog. It was so touching because, you know, I mean, look, let's face it. We see ourselves reflected in our pets, don't we? Anyway, Eddie, the dog in the book, lives with Jack on his boat. They go to a few restaurants together, in one case to Fisherman's Wharf. Not to be confused with me, because I no longer go to any restaurants in Fisherman's Wharf for a number of reasons which I will not discuss. But the character goes to Fisherman's Wharf. Eddie goes with him and he eats there. And Eddie does play a critical role in one action scene, which I cannot give away because it would destroy the moment. But I'll send you a free copy of Abuse of Power so you can read it yourself. Let me read you something I'm very, very happy with. It's something you're going to love because it's about Ernest Hemingway's boat, which I was always interested in. You know, Hemingway was one of my early heroes, and he owned a boat called the Pilar. I didn't know really what it was. I was a young guy living in the Bronx. I didn't know anything about boats. I figured anyone who had a motorboat was a millionaire, which they probably were at that time. And I figured Hemingway's boat was bigger than life because he was bigger than life. So I'm going to read you two paragraphs. So they were sitting in the aft salon of Jack's Aleutian 59. He dubbed the Sea Rider. He and Rachel had bought it during the real estate boom with money she made from flipping houses. Jack had been a liverboard for 2 years since moving out of the house in Tiburon he'd shared with his ex-wife. He often marveled that his boat was almost double the size of Hemingway's famous 38-foot Pilar, named for his second wife, Pauline, whose nickname was Pilar. It was the name of a pivotal character in For Whom the Bell Tolls. Built in Brooklyn, New York in 1934 by the Wheeler Shipyard, it had cost $7,455. Jack chuckled thinking about the 70-horsepower Chrysler-crowned gasoline engine, which drove her at 8 knots with a top speed of 16 knots. Jack's Aleutian had 2,000-horsepower Caterpillar diesels, which could drive his 40-ton beauty upwards of 22 knots. Jack also had a small apartment in town, but he rarely spent time there, preferring life on the marina instead. There was a sense of community here, of shared purpose, that you didn't get in the city. His friend Tony lived aboard the Tarangi, a 32-foot Choi Lee clipper just 3 slips down, a slot he'd managed to score despite size restrictions when one of the larger boats pulled anchor. So a day wouldn't be complete without Tony at least popping his head in, and more often than not, he brought along a bottle of wine. Tony considered himself something of a budget connoisseur and liked to share. Jack preferred beer or a single malt himself. His favorite combo was a few 85 Glenrothes, followed by a couple of cold Becks, but he indulged his friend's passion and usually gave in when offered a glass. Tony's selection tonight was an 04 Gaia Sori San Lorenzo, which he'd received in exchange for his mechanical skills on an Atomic IV engine. They toasted Officer Drabinski at the top. Tony picked up on it and gave him a tight-lipped smile. The wine was damn good, and it lifted his spirits from the first sip. It tasted unlike any other heavy red. He savored the understated layers of currant and black cherry with a tinge of coffee, but even his relaxed mind wasn't able to stray far from the events of the last 24 hours. And I'll stop there again. Abuse of Power, it's about Jack Hatfield's attempt to stop the next 9/11 in America. Believe me, nothing is held back. Incidentally, a caller who hung up, a woman from Boston, wondered if I had unconsciously been thinking of Holden Caulfield when I named Jack Hatfield. She said, isn't Jack Hatfield Holden Caulfield all grown up, still naive enough to believe in America?
Savage.
It is the Savage Nation, 1-800-449-8255. Again, if you missed my 9/11 speech, that was it for the radio version. I'm going to have it up on michaelsavage.com for as long as I can think forward, because so many people haven't heard it, and I think you need to circulate it. In that, I'd like you to compare it with what you heard over the weekend, the tepid nature of the fact that nobody would mention that it was conducted by radical Muslims who want to take over the world. I mean, let's be clear. If you were to listen to Mayor Bloomberg of New York, or I mean, how much worse does it get than them calling up an anti-war, anti-military, anti-police, anti-American twit like Paul Simon to sing a memorial for 9/11? How much worse does it get than having anti-war activists as people being called upon to memorialize this dastardly act against our nationhood instead of patriots, instead of soldiers? Unbelievable to me what went on. I couldn't watch it. I actually turned it off. I would turn it in and I would turn it off. I couldn't watch it. I couldn't stand looking at it anymore. I just couldn't stomach it. After about 10 minutes, I couldn't watch what I couldn't believe what I was seeing. New York, WOR. Michael, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Yeah, I was the same way. I just couldn't watch it. I couldn't believe not one person acknowledged that we're actually still at war. I mean, it's not Pearl Harbor. We're still at war with the terrorists. I think that was a great recruiting.
Wait, stop. You yourself just fell into the trap. We're still at war with who?
With the Islamic fundamentalists.
Thank you very much. See, now we've even changed the word from radical Islamists to Islamists, and now it's terrorists. And now they're just fighters. Very soon you'll be fighting fighters. And then very soon you'll be saying that we're fighting an invisible enemy of unknown origin. This is all brain. Michael, do you understand this is part of their propaganda war against America and the West, and they're winning? Because the media is compliant and playing along with them? I'm sure you do understand it.
Yeah.
Donnez plus clair les mots de la tribu. Michael Savage, you got a free copy of Abuse of Power. To make more clear the words of the tribe, Mallarmé. Remember reading that in my French literature classes in college. Mallarmé, the French poet. And he said his job as a poet was to make donnez plus clair la mot de la tribu. Pardon me for mangling the French. To make more clear the words of the tribe. Again, that's a rough translation. Meaning the poet is supposed to clarify for the tribe what they're feeling, because they can't see things as clearly as the guy who is the original poet. You understand that? That's actually what our job is in talk radio and in writing. To make more clear the words of the tribe. You're the tribe. You understand that? We're the shaman. We're not the leader. Make no mistake about it. We're not leaders. And the fools in the media who thought they were leaders, like a few who did rallies here and over there, they made the mistake. They didn't understand that they're not leaders. Talk show hosts are not really leaders. We are the shamans. We are the poets. We are the storytellers. Very important roles indeed. But we're not the leaders. Make no mistake about it. We have no direct power upon the outcome of events. We can only shape the thinking of events. But that unto itself is quite important. Not important enough for those with unlimited ego, apparently, who think that they need to lead mass rallies. And then they wind up themselves leading themselves into a Red Sea rather than through the Red Sea. Then they wind up engulfed by their own ego. Very difficult to avoid, incidentally. Very, very difficult to avoid, incidentally. It's something it took me years to understand. Oh, I led many rallies, compassionate conservative conventions, which led to tea parties across America, I'm proud to say. You could say I'm the grandfather of the tea parties in the country. I don't need anyone to tell me that. I can tell you by the conventions, which I have videotapes of. Ask anybody who was at them back in the 90s what they were like. They were beautiful events. They were patriotic events. They brought the walls down. They were amazing. I should put these tapes up one day. But the fact of the matter is, at that point, I was still not certain what my role was in the American the mindscape of the American geography, or the geography of the American mind. And then it took me a long while to understand that someone in the media is not a leader. And those who make the jump from the media into politics very often are never heard from again. Never heard from again. Witness that fat slob comedian who became a senator in Wisconsin or wherever they sent him up on an ice floe somewhere. In Cheeseland. They sent him up to Cheeseland. He was never heard from again. They dummied him up, shut him up, told him to keep quiet, or they wouldn't see a dime going into his state. No more jokes coming out of Fatso, right? And that's what happens when people go out of the media. I mean, very few make the transition. You take a guy like Mussolini. He was a journalist. He became a dictator. And look where he wound up, upside down, hanging like a slab of meat. Dallas, Texas, welcome to the Savage Nation. What's on your mind?
Yes, Dr. Savage, your book is and your excerpts are scaring the hell out of me.
Why?
It seems like you are so prophetic in what you've in the past. I don't know if it's a premonition or just your incredible insight on what can possibly happen if we don't wake up. And
well, let me say this. What is a premonition? See, there are people who don't understand that a premonition is actually, in some ways, if you're right often enough in your premonitions, what you're usually using is logic and reasoning to arrive at your so-called premonition. Not all premonitions come from the other world. Some of them come from thinking and analyzing. That's also a premonition. In other words, what's the CIA's job or what has it traditionally been but to have so-called premonitions about who's going to attack us and where and when, right? But they don't base that upon voodoo or upon a crystal ball. They base it upon intelligence. And then you can say, well, they had a premonition that they were going to do something and they stopped them. Okay. But the fact of the matter is any of us who use our minds on a regular basis can pretty much predict what's coming in some regard. And I'm telling you that in my book, Abuse of Power, I wrote the book in order to make sure we don't have another 9/11, only I set it in San Francisco with some seminal target that you'll immediately recognize that the radical Islamists in the hand of Allah want to do in order to show the world that they're still active. And Jack Hatfield is on to them right from the beginning, and he tries to stop them. And it's an amazing book because it brings in art, science, poetry, politics. It brings in, you name it, it's all in there thrown into this incredible novel. A lot of it is me, a lot of it isn't me. But I'm sending you a free copy in either case of Abuse of Power. Hope you read it and enjoy it. Salt Lake City, Utah. John, thanks. Interesting call. What's on your mind?
Hey, I'm interested in your book. Just wondering, you just said it's got a lot of topics in it. Since you do your show, you kind of you're kind of a restaurant critic, and you love food. I was wondering if there's any of that in it. Kind of a side note.
Oh, you know that I was going to take that call because, yes, there's a lot about food and wine in the book. And, in fact, there's two scenes in a restaurant in Fisherman's Wharf, which I don't really go to. I don't go to the Redneck Riviera for a number of reasons, not the least of which is that I don't like the crowd down there. But there is a scene in an Italian restaurant in North Beach called the North Beach Restaurant that's actually very real, a restaurant I do go to quite frequently. And the food is discussed, by the way. So there's also a meal discussed on a private jet, a Gulfstream 550, that is given to Jack courtesy of Senator Harold Wickham. I thought it'd be very interesting to talk about flying on a Gulfstream 550 because I think most people dream of flying on private jets, and I figured why not throw it in there, right?
Right. That and some meatball recipes or something like that.
Well, Jack doesn't do an awful lot of cooking on his boat, the Sea Rider. Wrighter, but he does his fair share of eating meatballs in the book, as you will see when you get your free copy going out to you tomorrow. 1-800-449-8255, michaelsavage.com. Chicago, Illinois. Mike, thanks for calling from WIND, the Windy City. What's on your mind?
And I had 2 points, and then I got a book I want to compare and see what you think about comparing against your Abuse of Power book. First point is, I think it was a fiasco, the television 911 thing. It was all commercialized. Secondly, they did a thing and they asked Obama where he was on 911. Who cares where he was at? And then the comparison to your book would be, I'm going to name, what do you want me to name, either the author or the book so you can figure out if you know that either one?
What do you mean? Oh, you mean the book that sounds like it's in that?
To
whatever you want to say. I don't know. You mean like what book does it sound like it belongs in what category?
There's a book I read that I believe that from what I'm hearing about your Abuse of Power, your book is going to be very much like that, very much readable, very much like it's just very interesting. And
you can name the book. I'm curious. What's the name of the book?
The name of the book, and then you tell me the author. The name of the book is Behind the Mask of the Phantom of the Opera.
Wow. I don't know, but you're getting a copy of Abuse of Power from Michael Savage. Stay on the line, 1-800-449-8255. What about my dream on the night before I went on the show today, which is D-Day tomorrow, the bookstore day, right, where I'm actually putting everything on the line? You don't even understand what I'm doing, what has to happen here. If my book does not go into the top 10 of fiction bestsellers, I'm never writing another fiction book. Do you understand that? Do you understand that this is a one-shot deal? In other words, I'm taking a gamble here. I took a gamble. The publisher took a gamble on me. I said to them, my audience will make the transition with me. But I don't know that you will. So if you're unhappy with movies, if you're unhappy with the orientation of movies where they never make an Arab the villain, they did in the beginning. Remember how popular 24 was with Jack Bauer? And then the minute they got complaints from CAR and the other pressure groups, they stopped making Muslims the enemy. Do you remember that one? Remember how popular it was because the people understood the danger that we are in because of the sleepers within? You understand that? Well, of course, it was a little too real for television, and Jack Bauer had to stop running after Muslims. Instead, he turned on to a Christian baldies, okay, in order to conform with Big Sis's view of who the enemy is. But the fact of the matter is, that's not who our enemy is, because they have been marginalized so long ago, they don't even exist. I've spoken to a former DEA agent, an undercover guy, who told me they're not a threat in this country. Don't believe anyone who says that they are. The only threats are the ones that we know are the threats. And my friend, it's much worse than you think. Jack Hatfield knows it. I hope you know it as well. Let's go to Portland, Oregon. Jay, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Thank you, Dr. Savage. It's always a pleasure and a privilege. Listen, going back to last spring when the Egyptian revolution was occurring, as they called it, you were the first that I know of that got on, speaking of premonitions, mind you, about the Muslim Brotherhood. And it was
That's amazing. Right. And it was the creep on CNN, the pretty boy on CNN, who was all excited about the Arab Spring because the jeans were just so beautiful and they all had blackberries. He didn't even understand what he was doing. He was feeding the flames of radical Islam the same way as they've done from the beginning. They cannot help but dancing with the devil because they have sympathy for the devil.
They do. And you made the second point, and that's what we're feeling right now. You don't hear about it. With the Israeli embassy getting thrashed this past week.
That's right. The Egyptians tore down the wall that was protecting the Israeli embassy. It was not covered by any of the vermin in the media because guess what? They're glad the Israeli embassy was attacked. In fact, my friends, I'm going to say something that will shock most of you. The media can't wait until Israel is overrun by a million foot soldiers from Iran. Boy, that'll make it on CNN. Wow, their ratings will go way up on Fox, wouldn't they? As they show cities burning and Jews being driven into the sea. My God, that's good for ratings, isn't it?
And that was what you've been calling.
Isn't that wonderful? And the whole world will have peace, according to Jimmy Carter. If only the Jews would be kicked out of the Middle East, the world would be at peace. Well, except, of course, for East Timor, except, of course, for a few problems with India, except, of course, for a few Russians like Putin who stand in their way. Why, now it's Israel, tomorrow it's the world. But don't tell that to Jimmy Carter, Brzezinski, and Barack Hussein Obama. I'm sending you a copy of Abuse of Power. I'll be right back.
Savage.
So those of you out there who are boaters, didn't you just love the piece I read you about Jack's boat compared to Hemingway's boat? I mean, I did some research on it. I was shocked to find that Hemingway's boat, Pilar, was only 38 feet. As a kid, that Pilar looked like it was a 90-foot boat to me when he was out in the waters of Cuba hunting for Nazi submarines with his Cuban fisherman companions. But you get older, you realize the world is different. It's smaller than you actually thought when you were a kid. Taking his cell phone from his pocket, he hit the flashlight app and the screen glowed. He shone the beam up the spiraled wooden stairway and cautiously climbed the steps to the flybridge, but there was no sign of anything amiss. A moment later, he was back inside the pilot house and headed down to the lower deck. He took the steps cautiously, keeping the 357 at the ready. He had no qualms about doing whatever was necessary to protect himself. When he reached the companionway, he stood very still, listening. The boat gently rocked, and the only sound was the quiet lapping of the bay against the hull. I'll stop right there because I can't give away a piece of the plot. This is so different than reading nonfiction on radio, I got to tell you. I knew this would be a challenge. See, with nonfiction, like when Trickle of Poverty came out, I could read whole chapters to you because it was straightly political. I probably, overdid it because I was so excited by what I was divulging to you. But I can't go to that extent in a fiction book because I'm going to give away elements of the plot which are going to destroy the suspense for you, Chicago, Illinois. Alan, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Yes.
Alan.
I had a two-part question for you. The first question is, the character Jack in the book, Abuse of Power, where was he raised at? Like, where did he grow up? And the second part of that question is, do you have any stories of him reminiscing about life-changing moments as a child?
That's very, very interesting. I actually don't think we talk about where he grew up other than his father was of a certain... His father was a clockmaker, And Jack has a hobby of fixing watches in the book, but there's no other mention of it, of his childhood in here. And as far as, what was the other question, Alan?
I was wondering if they meant you mentioned anything about him reminiscing about life-changing moments as a child, but apparently...
Well, he does reminisce a great deal about certain character quirks he has, emotional problems that are somewhat sedated by his working on watches when he feels crazy. In other words, this character, Jack, although he's an action figure, has a certain weakness that appears at moments of stress that are only resolved when he sits down in a quiet room and either works on clocks or watches and listens to them. And I describe in great detail this particular weakness. People have to understand that there are no fully 100% action figures in the world. No matter what the movies portray men as, all men have quirks and weaknesses, meaning they're human, right?
Yes.
Right. And most of us don't accept that as men because we want to pretend that we're like a superhero, when in fact we all know we're filled with the various and sundry problems that we have to cope with. And my character reflects that. It doesn't stop him from doing what he has to do to stop the next 9/11. But Jack Hatfield's a heck of a character, and I hope you're going to enjoy reading about him when I send you a free copy of my new novel, Abuse of Power. Let's go to the next caller, Sacramento Petri. Welcome to the program. Fire away.
Borders, language, culture. Man, that speech on 9/11, 2001 was 100% on it, Michael. You hit the nail on the head. I mean, that attack should have been realized as a final nail in the coffin to fight back with an iron fist. But no,
Bango.
They closed the borders. No, they just opened the doors.
No, they opened the borders. In fact, under Obama, Barack Hussein Obama and Big Sis, they're telling us that we can't even ask about the terrorists coming in disguised as Mexicans from Mexico. If we do, we'll be scrutinized by the FBI.
More asylum seekers come in, Islamo-fascists, illegal aliens, close the damn borders. If I'm going to wear a ribbon, give me a black ribbon, because that means, oh, man, it's just black.
I know. It's very emotional. Yes, black ribbon, you're right. But we know who the problem is, and we know who the enemy is, and we know who hit us on 9/11, and we have to give the enemy a name. Because let me tell you something that's very important for you to all know. The non-terrorist Muslim is just as frightened, just as terrified, just as existentially threatened by the radical Muslim, if not more so than we are. And that's very important for us to understand. They could be our greatest ally if only we weren't such chickens and so afraid to say that radical Islam is the enemy, but regular Muslims are our best ally. That's what has to be said, Petri. I'm sending you a copy of Abuse of Power before I blow my voice out on the Savage Nation. Lisa, fire away from New York on WOR. Go ahead, please.
Dr. Savage, for a while I've owed you a thank you. You had written about me and you were banned in Britain, and I refused to ever go back there. But I agree with you on Islam. Nobody is saying who attacked us. It's, Islam has been hijacked.
Do you know that the media had come to such a low point that they said today we're remembering 9/11 when two planes slammed into the World Trade Center? And I said, what did I just hear? You mean the two planes slammed into the World Trade Center by remote control, by accident? It was an accident? It wasn't conducted by 19 Saudis? Are they out of their minds? I was outraged all weekend. I couldn't believe how low we had come. We reached such a low point because of the left-wing media, that they would even have an anti-war, anti-military, anti-American like Paul Simon singing at such an event in New York to show you how low we had fallen. I'm sending you a copy of Abuse of Power, where my hero, Jack Hatfield, attempts to stop the next 9/11. Tomorrow is D-Day for Abuse of Power. I want you to go in and buy the book. I want you to call in tomorrow with your bookstore horror stories. Let's hope there are none. My dream is that there are no lib clerks, no hidden copies. It's all up front and exposed.
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
Now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
And here is what's on michaelsavage.com. Well, 9/11 is all over the news. As you well know, I'm very angry because Islam was expunged from the 9/11 memorial services around America. Here's America trying to move on and heal, and I can understand that. But you don't move on and heal by not defining who it is who hit you, okay? In an effort to produce an observance that can provide unity, they steered away from the fact the elephant in the room was radical Islam. If anybody brought into the issue of Islam, it was the liberal papers. What they're saying is that the Muslims were the victims of 9/11. I've never seen anything like this. I have never seen anything like this in my life. It's insanity. And I want you to listen to, well, there's a lot to be said about this. This is a war of terrorism. It's the forces and regimes of radical Islam. Radical Islam threatens moderate Islamic and Arab regimes. It threatens the very existence of the State of Israel. It's linking up with radical regimes throughout the Middle East, according to Benjamin Netanyahu, and I believe with him. But they won't mention the Muslim word, the I word, the terrorism word, not once. I got so angry listening to it yesterday because all I heard was, we're memorializing 9/11 when two planes crashed into the World Trade Center. Did they mean by accident? They didn't crash into, they were driven into. Now, this is a prologue to something that's very important for you to hear. We know about 9/11/01. In fact, my sound from 9/11/01, my monologue, is on michaelsavage.com, where I say, attention, America, radical Islam has created World War III. This is your Pearl Harbor. Listen to the whole thing and see if you disagree with the word. But my new novel, Abuse of Power, is all about one man, Jack Hatfield, my character, racing to stop another 9/11. And he finds out in this novel just how far up the abuse of power actually reaches. You'll be shocked to find out what I think in my new novel, Abuse of Power. It's more than a novel. It's chilling reality in some ways. In fact, well, it's worth reading. Abuse of Power, all bookstores now. Play the clip.
You want your hammer broke, you
We just wanted to hear your
story. I said bye now or you're going to get trespassing.
Well, we were leaving.
You are the sitting there. You know what, you dumb. You like your glasses? Don't threaten me, you
word, my friend.
Get the out of this parking lot right now.
Okay, you bet.
Bye.
Catch you later, brother.
Get out of here now.
You betcha, man.
Take your pictures. I'm not going to touch that. I'd in a heartbeat.
I'm with you.
Bye. Get out of the parking lot.
Did we get your name, sir?
You. That's my name. You.
Okay. All we wanted was your opinion about what's going on.
You got it.
Help you tell your story.
Wait for Jennifer Sargent to call you. Phony.
Come on, that's ridiculous. But identity theft is something you have to take seriously. What if someone stole your credit cards and tried to destroy your life? Don't be a victim. Call my advertiser, LifeLock, today. Call LifeLock now at 1-800-LOCK-485 and get 60 risk-free days just for Savage listeners. 1-800-LOCK-485. Call them now. Also on michaelsavage.com, FBI ends up offending Muslims at an outreach. Really? GOP's lead for Wiener seat shows Dems' vulnerability. UN death toll in Syria, at least 2,600, and of course, there's no Arab Spring there. You know what's very interesting? There was a letter in the newspaper from a reader named Emma Garcia about 9/11. It was one paragraph. Listen to what she said. She said it wasn't a spiritual struggle. It wasn't a spiritual struggle that in only a few centuries inspired, organized, and executed the Mohammedan conquest of the Arabian Peninsula, the Middle East, the Byzantine Empire, the Sassanid Persian Empire, North Africa, Sicily, the Iberian Peninsula to the Pyrenees, the Indian subcontinent, Central Asia, to the borders of China. No, it wasn't a spiritual struggle that spread Islam. It was jihad, holy war, a holy war whose limitless tactics and totalitarian strategies are outlined in detail in the ultimate military manual, the Quran, she writes. The same Quran, as well as the words and deeds of Muhammad, inspired and justified the millions of Muslims who funded, the thousands of Muslims who organized, and the few dozen Muslims who carried out the Islamic attack on America on 9/11/01. Emma Garcia, apparently you have not been blinded by the liberal forces of evil. That letter is up on michaelsavage.com. Also, does Christie's tepid speech end his political career, I ask? Because I listened to Christie's tepid speech commemorating 9/11, and it was a tepid speech. He's finished. Say you heard it here first. Taliban truck bomb hit a U.S. base in Afghanistan. Nearly 80 American soldiers were wounded again. Obama and Carter's Egyptian Springers attack Israeli embassy. You didn't read that, did you? 14,000 rounds of ammunition missing from Fort Bragg. A fugitive illegal alien cost the taxpayers of Florida $350,000 in free medical care. What else is on michaelsavage.com? Well, the New York Post was asking Warren Buffett and the B of A, was it illegal insider trading? They don't go for the nice guy or shucks game. Here's an interesting one for the anthropologists amongst you. Scientists are now saying that ancient humans bred with a lost African race. Our species may have bred with a now extinct lineage of humanity. Fascinating color pictures that I found for you on the website. You want to have a heartbreak? Lab chimps see daylight for first time in 30 years. You say these animals who are experimented upon have no feelings? Well, take a look at them on the YouTube piece, hugging each other in delight before they took their first steps out of the darkness of the cages they had been forced to live in for 30 years as they were experimented upon by evil scientists. That's right. The chimps were allowed out into daylight for the first time in 30 years, and the poor little animals hugged each other in delight as they looked at the light. Oh, no, they don't feel anything, huh? Finally, on michaelsavage.com, revisiting 9/11 unpublished photos. And if you're interested in education, we have another article. Urban schools are now teaching not reading, writing, and arithmetic, but beaten, rioting, and arithmetic. Beaten, rioting, and arithmetic, meaning how to add up your drug money. All this and more on the Savage Nation today.
Savage.
So before I go and take some more calls, which I don't really want to do right now, I want to read you another passage from Abuse of Power. If I could find the page, I don't know if I can. I really can't. I lost it. Remember he's talking with the Muslim in England who's going to help him? Well, they have an argument about radical Islam. I wish to God I could find it. Here it is. Is this? Here it is. I got it. Okay, so they go to London, him and the beautiful Sarah, the Muslim woman who is helping Jack Hatfield in my novel, Abuse of Power. And he says to him, we really do need your help, Faisal, Sarah goes on. The hand of Allah is planning an attack, a massive one, and that can only be bad for all of us. Not just Muslims, Jack added, but we're talking about the future of Western civilization here, your own son's future. Faisal looked torn. Jack wasn't sure whether he'd help or kick them out. Apparently, Faisal wasn't sure either, but then he took the USB key from Sarah and got to his feet, moved to his laptop on the table. And then I'm not going to give you the plot details. Later on, Sarah is asleep on the sofa. Jack slumps in the armchair across from her, only half awake when Faisal said, I know who you are, you know. That got Jack's attention. He pulled himself upright, unsure what to expect. Faisal sat at the dining table reading one of his textbooks. A clock on the wall said it was approaching 2 a.m. The decryption software had been running on the laptop for close to an hour, numbers and symbols skittering across its screen. Faisal looked up from his book. It took me a while to remember you. I saw your photograph in the newspaper some time ago. There was an article about the Home Secretary banning you from travel to this country. You're an American television host. Jack shrugged. Close enough. I remember because we talked about you at the college, about the things you've said, your hatred of Muslims, your desire to kill 100 million of us. Jack didn't like the direction this was heading. That was taken completely out of context. I don't hate all Muslims. Just a few, then? It was an accusation, not a question. I saw the mistrust in your eyes when you first looked at me. You have to understand my perspective, Jack said. There are a lot of radicals out there, like the Hand of Allah, people who would want to destroy America. Yes, and that's why I agree to help you and Sarah. But don't you see that when you say such hateful things, it makes men like me feel as if you're talking about us as well? I understand, but it's a very delicate balance. And I'm sure you have even more to fear from radicals than I do. You're 100% right about that, said the Muslim who's helping them. He was quiet a moment as he closed his book and stared at the laptop, watching the software do its magic. Then he said, but it isn't just the radicals. My mother is Indian and my father is Pakistani. And our extended family is a mix of many different beliefs. Some are liberal Muslims, and they may be well be the worst curse there is. Worse than those who want to kill people, bomb them? I don't condone such actions, and I never will, but the liberals are nearly as dangerous in their own way. People who think that pornography and degeneracy and gay marriage are normal, acceptable. To my mind, that's a bigger threat to the stability of Pakistan and the world than anyone can imagine. Jack relaxed a bit and had to stifle a smile. He almost felt as if he were in a bar back home talking American politics with Tony or the Reb. When I'm not at school, Faisal said, I work in a mobile phone store. There's another man who works there, a fundamentalist Christian, and we've had many conversations about our beliefs. And when it comes to social values, family values, we're in total accord. We agree on almost everything with regard to how life should be led. The laptop beeped and he checked the screen and then typed in a quick entry and started running it again. I'm reading from Abuse of Power by Michael Savage. The point I'm trying to make to you, he said, is that there are many varieties of Muslim, just as there are Catholics or Jews. There are Muslims who are not religious, yet use Islam as a political weapon. They have no interest in following the teachings, yet they're willing to kill for their own self-advancement. Do you realize that in some of our Muslim schools right here in England, they're teaching young students how to properly chop off the hands of thieves? You're kidding me, said Jack. I wish I were. It's right there in their textbooks. He paused, clearly disturbed by the thought. But there are other Muslims like me who are very religious, yet have no taste for violence, no desire to harm anyone. While I may detest what the liberals believe and think that their view of society is dangerous, I don't want to hurt or convert them. I simply want to be left alone, he said. There are many of us who feel that way. And how do you feel when one of those radicals sets off a bomb? Asked Jack. Just as frightened as you do, just as terrified, he paused. Why wouldn't I be? Point taken, Jack said. What I want to stress to you is that when you go on television and speak of Muslims, you should be very careful to separate us, not lump us all together. Well, that's true, but this isn't one-sided, you know. How do you think it feels when Americans are all seen as infidels? Well, those who say such things aren't speaking for me, Faisal told him. All I really want is peace throughout the world. That's all any true Muslim wants. We believe in the blessed words of all the prophets, from Moses to Jesus. We respect others and their religions, and all we ask is that they do the same in return. Jack knew all of this, of course, but it didn't hurt to have a face to attach to it. He had stereotyped Faisal, mistrusted him, the moment he'd walked in the door, and he regretted that. Well, that's good to hear, Jack said, and you're right, I will be more careful. Faisal nodded, satisfied to have had his say. He rose from his chair and gestured to the laptop. This will take some time, and I need to sleep. I'll check its progress in the morning. Thank you, Faisal. I know you didn't have to help us, and I appreciate what you're doing. Faisal gestured to Sarah, stretched out on the sofa. She looks comfortable there, but you can't sleep in that chair. I have a spare bedroom for when my family arrives. There's a bed. You're free to use it. Then he stepped into the hallway and disappeared. That's Abuse of Power. Michael Savage. Go to my website and order it. The next scene is a sex scene. Sure to blow the socks off everyone in the United States of America. Let's go to New York City on WOR. Time is short. Jay, you're on the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Dr. Savage. You've been saying for such a long time that liberalism is a mental disorder, and I wanted to give you an example that I heard that really reminded me of that. I heard on another station, a progressive saying that we should devote as much attention to Christian fanaticism and Christian radicalism as far as terror attacks go as we would to Islamic terrorism.
Now, that's the latest thing. That's coming from the Muslim fanatics who are in the Homeland Security Department. That's the official line of the federal family under Big Sis. She figured out that if you can bash Christians, you can curry favor with the Muslims. You know what I mean? And there's an awful lot of Muslims voting for Obama these days. Because his middle name ain't Christ. His middle name is Muhammad. See, I mean, his middle name ain't Muhammad nor Christ. I mean, his middle name, as you well know, is Hussein. And so, therefore, you got to understand where the numbers are. You're asking me another question, which is what causes liberalism the mental disorder? Isn't that your real question?
I mean, essentially, when I heard this...
Well, what causes liberalism is the desire to be loved. Liberals generally want to be loved by everybody. They don't want anyone to dislike them.
I want to be loved by you, just you, nobody else but you.
And it is. And by the way, most liberals are nice people. Most of them are very nice people. They don't bother anybody. They want to be left alone. And they figure that if they stay out of your life, you'll like them and they'll, you know, basically they're good. And their idea of a conservative is a Nazi. They think that most Republicans secretly have SA or SS uniforms and a picture of Hitler in their living room. And this, of course, is an example of the insanity of liberalism in its extremes, just as there are extremes on the conservative side, as exemplified by, I don't know who. Really, I don't even know of any extremists anymore. I think they've all left the right side. They're all leftists today. But nevertheless, the fact is that liberals have this horrible prejudice against any Republican, assuming, look at it this way. Most liberals think of them, try to visualize what a liberal is. In the form of a woman, it would be Larry David. In the form of a man, it would be Larry David. In the form of a woman, it would be Larry David in drag. That would be a woman liberal who at every turn, every chance he gets, he bashes Christians, the cross, or Christianity, and assumes that any Republican is a Nazi. This is a product of growing up, in my opinion, in a kind of a labor front home in New York City as a child, oil cloth on the floor. The father worked in the ILGWU, even though he was a man. He was in the needle trades one way or the other. And hated the owners and thought that one day there would be a workers' revolution and the workers would run the country. Well, take a look at every country where the workers have taken over and you'll see what happens when workers take over.
Savage.
Well, we know the Democrats are in a tailspin right now. I'm joined by Dr. Grace Bhutto to talk about the loss of the brand name within the Democratic Party as a result of the trickle-up poverty king, Obama. Okay, you say the Democratic Party now has an identity crisis. I don't believe that's true, but what's your opinion?
You know, I think that the conservatives don't fully understand how angry Democrats are at this president. He has destroyed the Democratic brand. Look at it from the point of view of progressives and leftists in this nation. This president campaigned on the promise that he was going to be some kind of a centrist, and he was going to build this grand new coalition. 2 years later, that coalition is in tatters with nothing to replace it. Let me explain how that's happened. When this president first assumed office, he decided he wanted a transformational legacy. And so what he did was he rammed Obamacare through Congress, even though the public had said that they were opposed to it. He forced his own party members to hold their nose and vote for it. And he told them, don't worry, the public will eventually reward you. Well, what happened was the exact opposite. During the midterm elections, moderates and conservative Democrats, they were just smashed to smithereens. They were destroyed. And the signal that this sent to the rest of the Democratic members in Congress is that this president cannot be trusted as a leader of the Democratic Party. So what you have now in Congress today is a group of Democrats, a rump Democratic Party that consists of far leftists, but not only are they far leftists, they also are each man out for himself because they don't believe that this president can deliver the goods. So from the pure analysis of a party machine, this president has badly damaged the structure of the Democratic Party.
Well, what do you mean when you think, when you say that you think the Democratic Party is leaderless? It doesn't seem leaderless to me.
Well, it's leaderless. Number one, nobody trusts him. The Democrats themselves do not trust him. Number two, and even the greater point that I really want to emphasize today, is that the Democratic Party no longer knows what it stands for. I challenge any Democrat out there to tell me, what does this Democratic Party represent in America today? Nobody knows. And that's because this president has been all over the map. And I can run down one example after the other. For example, the Democrats used to say that they stood for the little guy, the working class. Well, the working class today is in worse shape than it has been in several decades. The working class does not feel that this president has really delivered the goods for them. Does this president stand for the middle class? You know, one of the things the Clintons could boast is that they were the party of the middle class. Well, this party has not won the hearts and minds of the middle class. The middle class is still mired in economic recession, is still mired in great economic difficulties. The mortgage crisis has not been resolved, nor are there enough jobs out there. So the Democratic Party doesn't stand for the working class. It doesn't stand for the middle class. On the other hand, has it done anything to help big business? Well, it did bail out big business with massive bailouts, as I just said, and has big business rallied to the Democrats? Neither. Big business is holding on to the trillions of dollars that they possess, and they're not willing to invest in this economy because they don't trust him. So what did this president do from an economic point of view? There is no single constituency out there that can say, I really feel really rewarded by this president. My economic self-interest is advanced by him. So the Democratic Party cannot viably say that it represents any single economic constituency. So in that regard, he has smashed that identity. And in foreign policy, the situation is even worse. This president basically, this is what I would summarize his foreign policy as follows. To go off on extremely radical speeches and then to actually be Bush light. He has, in effect, continued the policies of the Bush administration, which has really angered the progressives. He had vowed that he was going to pull out the troops from Iraq within 6 months, and he did not do so. Then he escalated the war in Afghanistan. Then he launched a third war in Libya without the approval of Congress. This, in the eyes of radicals, being an even greater sin than any that Bush had ever committed. And so what we see here is that even in foreign policy, which Democratic constituency can really say, wow, he's my man. He really represents the reason that I voted for the Democratic Party. So what you're seeing now, Michael, is a Democratic Party that truly does not know what it stands for.
Do you actually see a possible primary challenge for Obama?
Well, there's a lot of rumblings now on the left that he should be challenged. And I would encourage all those who think so to go ahead and make those challenges. I think that the Democratic Party really needs to discuss where do we go from here. Let's backtrack just a little bit and give some historical context. The Democratic Party has failed to win re-election or even election on policies of big liberalism, tax and spend liberalism. By the 1990s, the Clintons understood very clearly there's only one way to win election in a nation that is, by and large, right of center. There's only one winning Democratic recipe, and Bill Clinton nailed it. That recipe is some kind of economic fiscal conservatism married to social liberalism. That, by the way, is the most devastating recipe from the point of view of conservatives. That's what we most have to fear, because that kind of an agenda will, over time, gradually move the country to the left. And as long as the Democrats had understood that, they were making significant progress, and that was the winning recipe even for re-election. However, what did this president do? He basically pretended that he was going to be a moderate, but when he came to power, he reverted back to the discredited policies of tax and spend, big government liberalism that this country has rejected over and over again. We thought the Democrats had learned their lesson. Instead, they obviously did not, based on what Obama has done. So my response is this. The Democrats do need to have a primary challenger. I think that in order for them to rebrand themselves, to rediscover what it is that they stand for, they need to hold this president accountable for what he has done to their party. Now, regarding do I see this as likely, I think that one of the major facts of the summer, Michael, has been growing liberal discontent. I have been shocked. Almost every day, there's another piece in an opinion piece in major organs of leftist opinion, basically trashing this president. And so, I do think it is likely that you're going to see some kind of a challenger.
You discuss different crisis points in the Democratic Party. Is there any chance that they will get through this crisis point?
There is only one way for the Democrats to get through this crisis. They have to challenge the president. They have to overturn him. They have to overthrow him from the ticket. They have to get somebody else to lead them. He has, in effect, betrayed what he promised that he was going to do to his own base. He has also betrayed individual Democratic members of Congress. This president can't be trusted as a Democrat. He has, by and large, destroyed the Democratic brand. And the only way that they are going to be able to salvage themselves is if they overthrow him and get and basically launch a fresh new start. Look, the polls don't lie. Right now, Democratic Party affiliation is at a 22-year low. Who out there wants to be a Democrat? Very, very few people. And one of the problems is they just don't even know what it means to be a Democrat. They don't know what it stands for. So the only way to overcome this crisis is to start fresh. And again, they've got to look at the person that was very successful in the past, and that was Bill Clinton. He launched the third way Democrat, the new way of doing things. Basically, Clinton came to power on the heels of the DLC, the Democratic Leadership Council, and they understood that they needed to champion some kind of economic fiscal restraint while advancing a social liberal agenda as the way to have a successful governing coalition. Unless they return to that, the Democratic Party is going to be smashed even further in 2012.
Okay. In your opinion, what's been the biggest mistake of President Obama?
The biggest mistake of this president is that he doesn't know what it means to lead any single institution in a way that actually creates consensus and growth. Essentially, President Obama believes too much in his own individual abilities. That is his great mistake. And what he does is he takes advantage of various institutions, say like the Democratic Party. No sooner has he used them, he discards them. He destroys them. He doesn't recognize the value of the very institutions that have given him power. He believes too much in himself as a one-man show. And I think the Democratic Party has to show him, you didn't get to your position of president all on your own. You're there because of an institution that supported you. This president has destroyed the very hand that fed him. And if you look at his track record, Michael, you realize that he does that to everything and everybody. And that's why I say he's a little bit like a promiscuous lover. To various constituencies, he will, you know, say sweet nothings in your ear and let you believe that he's really in love with you. And no sooner has he had his way, he will turn his back on you and abandon you. And that's what he's done to the Democratic Party. He has destroyed them, and he has let his own individual Congress members down. He will continue to do so because ultimately this president is in love with only one person, and that's himself.
Is there any way that President Obama wins a second term?
At this point, I think there is no way this president can win re-election. The stats out there are damning. He's losing. He's bleeding support with every major constituency. He's losing the female vote. He's losing the independent vote. He's losing the Hispanic vote. He's losing the white vote. He's losing the support of the youth. You look at all the statistics out there, they are damning of this president. So at this point in time, unless the Democrats do something dramatic, this president is going down, and he's taking his whole party down with him.
Dr. Grace, thanks for joining us today on The Savage Nation.
Michael, it was great speaking with you. The audience can see this article at the EdmundBurkeInstitute.org. Click on our Graceful Heritage, and the title is Obama Destroys the Democratic Brand.
This is The Savage Nation.
Savage.
I have to repeat something I said in my speech on Thursday. There are some in Washington who'd rather settle our differences through politics and the elections than try to resolve them now. And the next election is 14 months away. And the American people don't have the luxury of waiting 14 months for Congress to take action. So if you agree with me, if you want Congress to take action, then I'm going to need everybody here and everybody watching. You've got to make sure that your voices are heard. Help make the case. We can't afford these same political games, not now. So I want you to pick up the phone. I want you to send an email. Use one of those airplane skywriters. Dust off the fax machine. Or you can just, like, write a letter. So long as you get the message to Congress. Send me the American Jobs Act so I can sign it into law. Let's get something done. Let's put this country back to work.
Did you hear that? And it's organizations like the AARP who control these leftist politicians. AMAC is fighting back. The Association of Mature American Citizens. Your membership can help stop the left wing. Call 800-255-4199. 800-255-4199 or go to americaisrising.com. 800-255-4199. americaisrising.com. I want to give you a snapshot of my life, how boring it really is. On Saturday, I try to get an outboard motor that I have on the back of a runabout running. And an old friend of mine, a Jaguar mechanic, I know for, oh God, I know, 30 years, we ran into each other again at an auto show a year ago. So he came over. Now, this is a two-year-old Yamaha 20 horsepower, but because the gas got old, it didn't start a year ago. Then we restarted it, and it wouldn't start again, so I bought a new battery. We put that in. That took us an hour to get the thing running, but she keeps conking out when we reduce it to idle if we don't put it on a fast idle. So I just shut the thing down after letting it run for an hour and put it back up on the ramp because it's not nice enough weather to run it anyway. That was Saturday. Now, Sunday, yesterday, there were small craft advisories on San Francisco Bay. And I know better than to go out in a big powerboat in small craft advisory, but I wanted to get my merit badge in foul weather because, you know, no matter how, let's say, windy it is on a bay, it's still not the open ocean. It's nothing. So I arranged to go out with a guy who bamboozled me into telling me he was once, many years ago, in the Dutch Navy. Could you believe this? Nice enough guy. I knew him through some people. He had gone out with me one time before. He was a bit of a nervous Nelly. So I figured let him crew on the boat. Normally, I only go out with the dog because I don't like to talk with anyone on a boat. Now, I keep my boat like a model ship. The rails are varnished. The stainless steel is gleaming. Everything is perfect on my boats because I like a boat to be perfect. So I go out with this guy, and I give him a lecture on exactly how to what he's expected to do when I'm docking. Remember, I'm up on the flybridge, and I can't be on the deck at the same time. So I say to him, I'm going to call him John. I say, John, here's what you do. When I back her into the dock, you step off and you tie the stern line on first. I will then use the bow thruster and bring the bow around. And then I'll, you know, throw you a bow line. You'll bring a bow line down from the center, which you've tied. Yes, yes, I understand. I pull up to the dock in a fairly choppy wind, and I see something's going wrong. Nothing is right. I'm yelling, I'm screaming, the guy's not using the two-way radio, I can't get in touch with him. I look down, all of the lines that he tried to attach are in the water, that's number one. Number two, he tied a center line on, that's all we had. So blah, 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 after screaming and yelling, I see we're tied up a little. I finally come off the flybridge to help correct it. And you know what he says to me? I think that I may have caused you some damage. I said, what? What happened? I figured maybe I scuffed the dock or something. You know what this idiot did? He took the line. These are big, thick, heavy lines that you tie up. This is a 40-ton boat that you tie up against the dock. Instead of running a line through a cleat out onto the dock, he wrapped it around a stainless steel rail, which I didn't know, and it broke the stainless steel rail off of my boat. Can you believe this? And then the guy has the nerve to say to me, I'm not sure I actually did it. I went ballistic, screaming. Are you at blah, blah, blah? So then I calmed down. We removed the rail. It took a good hour to get the rail off. I had broke off half the screws unscrewing them. I got a 10-foot section, and I'm going to show you how beautiful this country really is when you get down to the working-class man. I want to show you what goes on with boatsmanship. I mean, most guys have captains who do all of this. I like to have my hands into all of it. It gives me a sense of reality. I just happened 2 weeks ago to have bought a new cordless DeWalt screwdriver because there's a bit of an eddy in me. I grew up fixing things in my dad's shop. And I like to use tools on a mild basis. I bought the most, the sweetest tool set I've ever seen with new bits. I had no idea why I was buying it. Well, it was for yesterday. So now there's about 12, 14 screws that have to come out, right? In addition to the stanchion that broke, there were four others that were screwed in. So in unscrewing the stainless steel screws, about 6, 7 of them, the heads broke off and the screws got stuck in the wood, if you know what I'm talking about. Then the last two screws, I couldn't get the screwdriver into it. I had to pull them out by wrench. I had to yank them out by wrench. Luckily, I'm a little handy. So I got the rail off. Now, that's step one. Now I call 5 different people. Do you know anyone who can fix stainless steel without ruining it? Because it's only a 15-degree bend. Everyone says, yeah, you got to go to Werner's Welding in Sausalito, one of the old-timers on the dock. His dad was a welder. Well, guess what? I brought the iron down in my car to my good friends at List Marine. They're the greatest mechanics around. And they held the rail for me because Werner wasn't in. And then he called me later. He says, is this the Michael Savage? I said, yes. I never met him. He says, I've loved your show from the beginning. I've listened to you back since the early days. He said, you know what? I'm leaving on vacation tomorrow. I go away every year this time. He said, but I'll fix your stainless steel the best I can today. I'll get it done today.
Savage.